Mr. President, we've reached another moment of importance this week in debating the fiscal year 2008 Defense Authorization Bill. We'll help set the course of the nation's security policy and influence our participation in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Much of the debate, as we all know, will be about Iraq. And before I discuss that in my recent visit, I'd note that many provisions in this bill constitute a good defense policy and will strengthen the ability of our country to defend itself. Under the leadership of my good friend from Michigan, the chairman of the committee, Senator Levin, I think we have crafted an excellent piece of legislation. I think a testimony to his leadership is that the committee voted unanimously to report the bill, and it fully funds the president's $648 billion defense budget request. It provides necessary measures to try to bring under control waste, fraud, and abuse in defense procurement. And it makes, frankly, members more accountable for their spending and the earmark process. Again, I'd like to thank Chairman Levin, the subcommittee chairs, and all the committee chairman members for their work in bringing this issue to the floor. Very briefly, Mr. President, we've authorized a 3.5% across-the-board pay raise for all military personnel. We've increased Army and Marine in-strength to 525,400 and 189,000 respectively. The committee also approved $2.7 billion for items on the Army Chief of Staff's unfunded requirement list, including $775 million for reactive armor and other striker requirements, $207 million for aviation survivability equipment, $102 million for combat training centers, and funding for explosive ordnance disposal equipment, night vision devices, and machine guns. The bill also authorizes $4.1 billion for mine-resistance ambush-protected vehicles, known as AMRAP, for vehicles for all the services known requirement. The committee has come up with the money to support our troops, and I have no doubt that the full Senate will follow step. Money and policy statements are not all that's required at this moment in our national history. Courage is required. Courage. And not the great courage exhibited by the brave men and women fighting today in Iraq and Afghanistan, but a smaller measure. The courage necessary to put our country's interests before every personal or political consideration. In this light, I'd like to discuss America's involvement in Iraq. Final, and I'd like to make several points. Final reinforcements needed to implement General Petraeus's new counterinsurgency tactics arrived just several weeks ago. Last week, I had the opportunity to visit these troops in theater. From what I saw and heard while there, I believe that our military, in cooperation with the Iraqi security forces, is making progress in a number of areas. There are other areas where they are not. I'd like to outline some of their efforts, not to argue that these areas have suddenly become safe. They have not. I want to emphasize the areas have not become safe, but illustrate the progress that our military has achieved under General Petraeus's new strategy. Last year, Anbar province was believed to be lost to Al-Qaeda. On the map, we see that U.S. and Iraqi troops cleaned out Al-Qaeda fighters out of Ramadi and other areas of western Anbar. Tribal sheikhs broke with the terrorists and joined the coalition side. It is a fact that some 16 out of the 24 sheikhs in the Sunni area of Anbar province have now joined with U.S. forces in their commitment to destroy Al-Qaeda in Anbar province. Ramadi, months ago, was Iraq's most dangerous city, now one of its safest. Considerable political risk, I point out, that I visited with Senator Graham downtown Ramadi, where the shopping areas were open. I did not visit without protection or without security forces with me. But the fact is that a short time ago, it was one of the most dangerous cities in all of Iraq. Attacks are down from 30 to 35 a day in February to most to zero in most days now. In Fallujah, Iraqi police have established numerous stations and have divided the city into gated districts. Violence has declined, and local intelligence tips have proliferated. Throughout Anbar province, thousands of young men are signing up for the police and army, and the locals are taking the fight to Al-Qaeda. All 18 major tribes in the province are now on board with the security plan. A year from now, the Iraqi army and police could have total control of security in Ramadi, allowing American forces to safely draw down. South of Baghdad, Operation Phantom Thunder is intended to stop insurgents present in the Baghdad belts from originating attacks in the capital itself. A brigade of the 10th Mountain Division, which I visited, is operating in Baghdad belts that have been havens for Al-Qaeda. All soldiers in the brigade are living forward. That means they are in outposts away from the headquarters 24/7, living, working, and fighting alongside Iraqi military. And commanders report that the local sheikhs are increasingly siding with the coalition against Al-Qaeda. Southeast of Baghdad, the military is targeting Al-Qaeda in safe havens they maintain along the Tigris River. In Baghdad itself, military in cooperation with Iraqi security forces continue to establish joint security stations and deploy throughout the city. These efforts have produced some positive results. Sectarian violence has fallen since January. The total number of car bombings and suicide attacks declined in May and June. The number of locals coming forward with intelligence tips has risen. Make no mistake, violence in Baghdad remains at unacceptably high levels. Suicide bombers and other threats pose formidable challenges, and other difficulties abound. Nevertheless, there appears to be overall movement in the right direction. Mr. President, I have no doubt how difficult suicide bombers are to counter. Ask the Israelis. Literally had to seal their borders with Gaza and the West Bank because of the way that people were willing to sacrifice their own lives in order to take the lives of others are able to get through and do these horrendous acts that that we are exposed to quite often on our television screens and in our newspapers in America. Diyala province, Iraqi and American troops have surged and are fighting to deny Al-Qaeda sanctuary in the city of Bakuba. For the first time since the war began, Americans showed up in force and did not quickly withdraw from the area. In response, locals have formed a new alliance with the coalition to counter Al-Qaeda. Why are some of these people now turning against Al-Qaeda, Mr. President? One reason is because of the extreme cruelty that is practiced by Al-Qaeda on a routine basis, which has caused many people to reject that kind of extreme violence and cruelty inflicted on the local people. Diyala, which was the center of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi's proposed Islamic Caliphate, finally has a chance to turn aside the forces of extremism. I offer these observations not in order to present a rosy scenario of the challenges we can continue to face in Iraq. As last weekend's horrific bombing in Salahuddin province illustrates so graphically, the threats to Iraqi stability have not gone away, nor are they likely to go away in the near future, and our brave men and women in Iraq will continue to face great challenges. What I do believe is that while the mission to bring a degree of security to Iraq and to Baghdad and its environs in particular, in order to establish the necessary preconditions for political and economic progress, while that mission is still in its early stages, the progress our military has made should encourage us. It's also clear that the overall strategy that General Petraeus has put into place, a counterinsurgency tactic that emphasizes protecting the population, and which gets our troop off of the bases and into the areas they're trying to protect, that this strategy is the correct one. Some of my colleagues argue that we should return troops to the forward operating bases and confine their activities to training and targeted counterterrorism operations. That's precisely what we did for 3.5 years, and the situation in Iraq got worse. Over 3.5 years, we had our troops from operating bases going out, search and destroy, as we used to call it during the Vietnam War, and go back to their bases. A failed strategy from the beginning. I'm surprised that any of my colleagues would advocate a return to the failed Rumsfeld-Casey strategy. No one can be certain whether this new strategy, which remains in the early stages, can bring about greater stability. We can be sure that should the United States Senate seek to legislate an end to the strategy as it is just beginning, then we will fail for certain. Now that the military effort in Iraq is showing some signs of progress, the space is opening for political progress. Yet rather than seizing the opportunity, the government of Prime Minister Maliki is not functioning as it was, as it must. I will repeat, the government of Prime Minister Maliki is not functioning as it must. We see little evidence of reconciliation and little progress toward meeting the benchmarks laid out by the president. The Iraqi government can function. The Iraqi government can function. The question is whether it will. To encourage political progress, I believe that we can find wisdom in several suggestions put forward recently by Henry Kissinger. Intensified negotiation among the Iraqi parties could limit violence, promote reconciliation, and put the political system on a more stable footing. We should promote a dialogue between the Iraqi government and its Sunni Arab neighbors, specifically Egypt, Jordan, and Saudi Arabia, in order to build broader international acceptance for the Iraqi central government in exchange for that government meeting specific obligations with respect to the protection and political participation of the Sunni minority. We should begin a broader effort to establish a basis for aid and even peacekeeping efforts by the international community keyed to political progress in Iraq. In taking such steps, we must recognize that no lasting political settlement can grow out of a U.S. withdrawal. On the contrary, a withdrawal must grow out of a political solution, a solution made possible by the imposition of security by coalition and Iraqi forces. Secretary Kissinger is correct when he says precipitate withdrawal would produce a disaster. It would not end the war, but shift it to other areas like Lebanon or Jordan or Saudi Arabia, produce greater violence among Iraqi factions, and embolden radical Islamists around the world. The war, he goes on to say, the war between the Iraqi factions would intensify. The demonstration of American impotence would embolden radical Islamism and further radicalize its disciples from Indonesia and India to the suburbs of European capitals. What America and the world need is not unilateral withdrawal, but a vision by the administration of a sustainable political end to the conflict. As I said before, withdrawals must grow out of a political solution, not the other way around. The Shias and the Sunnis and the Kurd, they need the buttress of a diplomatic process that could provide international support for carrying out any internal agreements reached or contain their conflict if the internal parties cannot agree and Iraq breaks up. The American goal should be an international agreement regarding the international status of Iraq. It would test whether the neighbors of Iraq, as well as some more distant countries, are prepared to translate general concepts into converging policies. It would provide a legal and political framework to resist violations. These are the meaningful benchmarks against which to test American withdrawals. He goes on to point out that Turkey has repeatedly emphasized it would resist a breakup by force because of the radicalizing impact that a Kurdish state could have on Turkey's large Kurdish population, that this would bring Turkey into unwanted conflict with the United States and open a Pandora's box of other interventions. Saudi Arabia and Jordan dread Shiite domination of Iraq, especially if the Baghdad regime threatens to become a satellite of Iran. The various Gulf sheikhdoms, the largest of which is Kuwait, find themselves in an even more threatened position. Syria's attitudes are likely to be more ambivalent. Its ties to Iran represent both a claim to status and a looming vulnerability. Given a wise and determined American diplomacy, even Iran may be brought to conclude that the risks of continued turmoil outweigh the temptations before it. Mr. President, he goes on to talk about a multilateral framework, and a forum for such an effort already exists in the Foreign Ministers Conference that met recently at Sharm el-Sheikh, and it's in the United States' interest to turn the conference into a working enterprise under strong, if discreet, American leadership. Mr. President, he goes on to say, neither the international system nor American public opinion will accept as a permanent arrangement an American enclave maintained exclusively by American military power in so volatile a region. Mr. President, I believe Secretary Kissinger is correct, and I believe that he's correct when he bases the premise that precipitate withdrawal would produce a disaster. Many of my colleagues would like to believe that should any of the various amendments forcing withdrawal become law, it would mark the end of this long effort. They are wrong. Should the Congress force a precipitous withdrawal from Iraq, it would mark a new beginning, start of a new, more dangerous, more arduous effort to contain the forces unleashed by our disengagement. Our efforts in Iraq today are critical to the wider struggle against violent Islamic extremism. Already the terrorists are emboldened, excited that America is talking not about winning in Iraq, but is rather debating when we should lose. Last week, Ayman al-Zawahiri, al-Qaeda's deputy chief, said that the United States is merely delaying our, quote, inevitable, unquote, defeat in Iraq, and that the Mujahideen of Islam in Iraq of the Caliphate and Jihad are advancing with steady steps towards victory. If we leave Iraq prematurely, jihadists around the world will interpret the withdrawal as their great victory against our great power. Their movement thrives in an atmosphere of perceived victory. We saw this in the surge of men and money flowing to al-Qaeda following the Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan. If they defeat the United States in Iraq, they will believe that anything is possible, the history is on their side, and that they really can bring their terrible rule to lands the world over. Recall the plan laid out in a letter from Zawahiri to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi before his death. That plan is to take shape in four stages: establish a caliphate in Iraq, extend the jihad wave to the secular countries neighboring Iraq, clash with Israel, none of which shall commence until the completion of stage one, expel the Americans from Iraq. Mr. President, the terrorists are in this war to win it. The question is, are we? Withdrawing before there's a stable and legitimate Iraqi authority would turn Iraq into a failed state and a terrorist sanctuary in the heart of the Middle East. We've seen a failed state emerge after U.S. disengagement once before, and it cost us terribly. In pre-9/11 Afghanistan, terrorists found sanctuary to train and plan attacks with impunity. We know that today there are terrorists in Iraq who are planning attacks against Americans. I don't think we should make this mistake twice. Brent Scowcroft, who we also know was opposed to the invasion of Iraq in the first place, has said, quote, "The costs of staying are visible. The costs of getting out are almost never discussed. If we get out before Iraq is stable, the entire Middle East region might start to resemble Iraq today. Getting out is not a solution." One of my great heroes and role models, and a person who I've had the great honor of getting to know recently, is Nathan Sharansky, a man of inestimable courage and knowledge. He recently had a piece on Sunday in the Washington Post, and he talks about Leave Iraq and Brace. His title of his piece is Leave Iraq and Brace for a Bigger Bloodbath. In his statement, he talks about the truth is that in totalitarian regimes, there are no human rights, period. The media do not criticize the government, parliaments don't check executive power, courts don't uphold due process, and human rights groups don't file reports. He talks about the moral divide that separates societies in which people are slaves from societies in which people are free. Some human rights groups undermine the very cause they claim to champion, he says. Consider one 2005 Amnesty International report on Iraq. It notes in the lawless climate of the first months after Hussein's overthrow, reports of kidnapping, rapes, and killing of women and girls by criminal gangs rose. Iraqi officers at a police station in Baghdad said in June 2003 that the number of reported rapes was substantially higher than before the war. The implication was that human rights may not really be improving in post-Hussein Iraq. But the organization ignored the possibility that reports of rape at police stations may have increased for the simple reason that under Hussein it was the regime, which included the police, that was doing the raping. He goes on to say, a precipitous withdrawal of U.S. forces could lead to a bloodbath that would make the current carnage pale by comparison. I'm quoting from Nathan Sharansky. Without U.S. troops in place to quell some of the violence, Iranian-backed Shiite militias would dramatically increase their attacks on Sunnis. Sunni militias backed by the Saudis or others would retaliate in kind, drawing more and more of Iraq into a vicious cycle of violence. If Iraq descended into full-blown civil war, the chaos could trigger similar clashes throughout the region as Sunni-Shiite tensions spill across Iraq's borders. The death toll and the displacement of civilians could climb exponentially. He says, perhaps the greatest irony of the political debate over Iraq is that many of Bush's critics who accused his administration of going blindly to war without considering what would happen once Hussein's regime was toppled now blindly support a policy of withdrawing from Iraq without considering what might follow. In this respect, the debate over Iraq is beginning to look a lot like the debate about the Vietnam War in the 1960s and 70s. Then, too, the argument in the United States focused primarily on whether U.S. forces should pull out. But many who supported that withdrawal in the name of human rights did not foresee the calamity that followed, which included genocide in Cambodia, tens of thousands slaughtered in Vietnam by the North Vietnamese, and the tragedy of hundreds of thousands of boat people. Mr. President, Mr. Sharansky lives in the neighborhood. Mr. Sharansky understands the meaning of the word freedom. Mr. Sharansky understands the meaning of the word sacrifice. I would urge all my colleagues to, and I ask unanimous consent that Mr. Sharansky's and Mr. Kissinger's piece be included in the record at this time.
Without objection, so ordered.
Mr. President, should we leave Iraq before there's a basic level of stability, we will invite further Iranian influence at a time when Iranian operatives are already moving weapons, training fighters, providing resources, and helping plan operations to kill American soldiers and damage our efforts to bring stability to Iraq. Iran will comfortably step into the power vacuum left by a U.S. withdrawal, and such an aggrandizement of fundamentalist power has great potential to spark greater Sunni-Shia conflict across the region. Leaving prematurely would induce Iraq's neighbors, including Saudi Arabia and Jordan, Egypt, Israel, Turkey, and others, to feel their own security eroding and may well induce them to act in ways that prompt wider instability. The potential for genocide, wider war, spiraling oil prices, and the perception of strategic American defeat is real. This fight is about Iraq, but not about Iraq alone. It's greater than that and more important still about whether America still has the political courage to fight for victory or whether we will settle for defeat with all of the terrible things that accompany it. We cannot walk away gracefully from defeat in this war. General Petraeus and his commanders believe that they have a strategy that can, over time, lead to success in Iraq. General Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker will come to Washington in September to report on the status of their efforts and those of the Iraqis. They ask just two things of us: the time necessary to see their efforts can succeed and the political courage to support them in their work. I believe we should give them both. Madam President, I know that senators are tired of this war, tired of the mounting death toll, tired of the many mistakes we've made in this war and the great effort it requires to reverse them, tired of the war's politicization and the degree to which it has become embroiled in partisan struggles and election strategies. I understand this fatigue, and yet I maintain that we as elected leaders with a duty to our people and the security of their nation cannot let fatigue dictate our policies. The soldiers I met last week have no illusions about the sacrifices necessary to achieve their mission. On July 4th, I had the great privilege to be present as 588 troops re-enlisted in the military and another 161 were naturalized as U.S. citizens. Tragically, two of those who were scheduled to be naturalized as U.S. citizens were killed very shortly before the ceremony. Those men and women taking the oaths of enlistment and citizenship in the center of Saddam's Al-Fa Palace, they understand the many hardships made in our name. They have completed tour after tour away from their families, risking everything, everything for the security of this country. They do so because they understand that, however great the cost of this war, the costs are immeasurably greater still if we abandon it prematurely. All they ask is that we support them in their noble mission. I wish we had planned to fight this war correctly the first time, but we can no more turn back the clock to 2003 than we can wish away the consequences of defeat by imposing some artificial deadline for withdrawal. Last week in Iraq, I met the bravest men and women our country has to offer, and not one of them told me that it was time to go, or that the cause is lost. They are frustrated with the Iraqi government's lack of progress. They are buffeted by the winds of partisanship in Washington, talking today of surges and tomorrow of withdrawal, voting to confirm General Petraeus and then voting for a course that guarantees defeat. But in the end, they know that the war in Iraq is part of a larger struggle, a war of moderation and stability against the forces of violence and extremism. They recognize that if we simply pack up and leave, the war doesn't end. It merely gets harder. Madam President, finally, I'd like to just a couple of quotes. General Lynch, who is the 3rd ID commander of U.S. forces, says, pulling out before the mission was accomplished would be a mess. You'd find the enemy regaining ground, reestablishing sanctuaries, building more IEDs, and the violence would escalate. General Anthony Zinni, one of my particular heroes, said, who opposed the war in Iraq, reality is that we cannot simply pull out of Iraq as much as we may want to. The consequences of a destabilized and chaotic Iraq sitting in the center of a critical region of the world could have catastrophic implications. There is no short-term solution. It will take years to stabilize Iraq. How many? I believe at least 5 to 7. In the Baker-Hamilton report, there's a lot of selective quoting, but I'd like to point out that they said, because of the importance of Iraq, the potential for catastrophe and the role and commitments of the United States in initiating events that have led to the current situation, we believe it would be wrong for the United States to abandon the country through a precipitate withdrawal of troops and support. A premature American departure from Iraq would almost certainly produce greater sectarian violence and further deterioration of conditions, leading to a number of the adverse consequences outlined above. The near-term results would be a significant power vacuum, greater human suffering, regional destabilization, and a threat to the global economy. Al-Qaeda would depict our withdrawal as a historic victory. If we leave and Iraq descends into chaos, the long-range consequences could eventually require the United States to return. That's page 30 of the Iraq Study Group report. Finally, Mr. President, I understand, I believe very well how difficult this issue is for many of our members. I know the sorrow and the frustration that they and their constituents feel. And if I knew a great option as to how we can preserve our nation's security and withdraw and stop the unfortunate casualties that are incurred by these brave young people, I would embrace it tomorrow. And part of this debate is going to be proposals that people have made about how we can best leave. And I want to engage in vigorous discussion and debate. And I would like to again begin this debate by pointing out that I respect the views of my colleagues on this issue. I understand their frustration. I intend to be respectful of their views, and I hope that we can have a debate and discussion on this issue as we consider various amendments that will better inform the American people of both points of view on this issue. And I hope over time, Madam President, that somehow we can find a way to come together in this body and in this nation, because this war has divided this nation in the most terrible way. I saw it once before. I saw it once before a long time ago. And I saw a defeated military. And I saw how long it took a military that was defeated to recover. And I saw a divided nation beset by assassinations and riots and a breakdown in a civil society. That's why we need, in my view, to try to come together, and I don't know how we do that, but to try to come together in the most beginning with respecting each other's views, and so that we can come together and hopefully end the tragedy of Iraq and at the same time ensure America's security. I'll be saying a lot more on this issue as we continue the debate, and I say again, I respect the views of my colleagues, and then finally, I would like to again, pay my compliments to the distinguished chairman of the committee who put together, as is his wont, a bipartisan package that will ensure our nation's security in the future, as exemplified again by a unanimous vote of the committee in reporting out the Defense Authorization Bill. I yield the floor.